It's Wednesday, December 1st, 2010, and you're listening to episode 214 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 51 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
This is Wayne.
This is Johan.
This is John.
Oh, sorry, I forgot about John.
God,
my bad.
Chris. Precedence.
Forgot about Dre.
He's old and has already forgotten John is here.
John who?
What?
John Yaya.
Where am I?
Alrighty.
John Smallberries. Did you guys ever see Buckaroo Banzai?
No.
No.
A long time
ago. Classic movie. Classic geek movie, as a matter of fact.
Yeah? It's a good movie.
Did you read the old Penny Circular?
Yeah, I was going to say, what's your favorite radio show?
When I was a kid, I'm not kidding you, when I was
Amos
a kid,
and Andy.
The JCPenney catalog was the thing to get, and not for the bras,
and
that was the Sears.
Too.
That was for the Sears.
No, that was Sears, you already beat me to it.
You did your business to the Sears catalog because that was way better. The Penny's catalog had the toys in there, and that's where you had all the toys, that's where all the Star Wars stuff was. That's actually
I got my
Redbox from. That's where I saw my first D&D Redbox was from there.
You mentioned radio shows, and I actually got into a kick of that for a while.
Did you really?
Going out and getting all the old, you can get them on like CD now and things.
I think they're all free on the internet.
Yeah, a lot of
like,
them are.
So
you can,
old.
There's a bunch of podcasts of them, and you can go out and just download them. Yeah. I got into a huge kick of radio shows for a while.
Oh, yeah. I used to listen to the original Star Wars radio drama was fantastic. The one they did on NPR back in the early 80s. That one was very well done. They even had some of the originals. Mark Hamill was in there. They got Billy Dee Williams
in
there as
well. You mean he wasn't busy doing that other thing?
What's that?
You mean Mark Hamill wasn't booked?
That's before he was Joker.
Yeah,
so
Batman the Animated Series was about 45 years off or whatever. So. And three car wrecks and 20
surgeries.
To
kill.
No kidding. I would like puke myself in nervous joy if I actually met Luke Skywalker.
We should get him as an
interview. I saw him when he was at Gen Con. One year when I was at Gen Con, Mark Hamill was there. I literally was about 30 feet away from him. I didn't go in the autograph line because it was too long and I had other stuff going on. Just like you said, John, I just stood there and I just stared. I just stared at him like stalker-like, just looking at him as he was like signing autographs.
You know what?
I make a promise to all of you now. If I ever meet Mark Hamill, I'm going to walk up to him and be like, oh my God. You're Blair from Wing Commander.
I would have gotten to do the laugh if we ever had him on the mics. I mean, the first thing I'd do, can you do the laugh? Do the laugh.
Oh, yeah.
Laugh.
You know what this reminds me of? Just talking about all this stalker stuff was when John and I were at Icon. As I said before, growing up, I was a huge Ghostbusters fan, and so were my sisters. And I had one of my sisters up there with me, along with her husband, whose name also happens to be Adam. And while we're sitting there, Ernie Hudson comes into the room. And so Adam whips out his video camera and they've got a videotape of the poor guy like serving mustacholi onto a paper plate as he's trying to go down a buffet line.
I peed next to him.
Nice.
Cool guy.
My big geek celebrity thing was a couple of years ago, I guess probably 4 or 5 years ago now, I was at the Superman Celebration in Metropolis. And they had both the actress that played Ursa and the actor that played Nan in the second Superman movie. So two of the Kryptonian villains. I actually go up to Ursa. I'm having this conversation with her. I ask her to stand up and pose with me with pictures. I get pictures of her giving me a hug. And I took that picture everywhere with me for the next year, showing it to everyone, saying, see, she wanted me.
She was in Conan the Destroyer, too.
She did want me, too.
Absolutely. Probably my biggest was like that when I interviewed Chewbacca at Gen Con a couple years back. That was awesome. He looked so thrilled to be there, let me tell you.
Dude, he is infamously a douche at the cons. Like,
he was actually really nice about it. And I tried to steer the question. It's still online. I still have it on YouTube. I actually tried to steer the questions away from like the typical fanboy questions. At least I remember trying to do that.
Other things he's done.
Tell me about your other career exploits.
What's hilarious is we're talking about looking longingly at stars and steering conversations away as Dan looks longingly at his outline of the show as we steer it away.
All right, dumbass is referring to my hosts, not my listeners. Two announcements. First off, Fear the Con 4, still coming up, fearthecon.com.
There's a decent selection of activities already or events at Fear the Con already. I'm impressed.
I'm still keeping my promise of I'm trickling mine out. I have one up so far.
You're doing them out.
I will be posting a second one here pretty soon. I fear I'll do about one a month. I did my November one, so I got a December, January, and February one left to go. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. The con is shaping up very nicely, looking at the early numbers and early activities. The second thing is with Cataclysm about to drop. Chads, who's not here right now, wanted me to mention the World of Warcraft Guild that is being run by some people that listen to the show. As we've said before, it's not our guild, but we do participate in it. And it's a lot of booters
in
there.
It's called Fear the Guild.
Yeah.
It's the FTB Guild.
If you're looking to get back into WoW with Cataclysm dropping and you're looking for a guild to run with, these are a great bunch of people, unbelievably helpful and friendly. And I will put a link to the forum area in the show notes so you guys can find all the necessary information for getting signed up with that.
That way you can play with Pat and he won't talk to you either.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah.
I'll ignore you in chat.
I'll be playing after finals are over.
There's been several times that we have talked on the show in response to things that people have put on the forums or sent us via email. But just so that third category of people knows we're not ignoring them, the folks that post on the blog, there was a gentleman who signed his post as Hal, so we'll presume that's his real name, in response to episode 211, which was the one on dramatic tension. And he posted several thoughts on that subject and some things that kind of branch out in sort of ancillary directions that I would love to kick around. So let me read this soon. I'm going to read this in portions and then we'll pause throughout this to comment. But he starts by saying, it seems to go without saying for you guys, but there is one assumption you kept making throughout the episode, that you have a good GM, one who knows how to tell a story and keep the players engaged. I realize every episode can't include GMing Basics 101, but I think there's something to be said for establishing that player buy-in as a prerequisite for any dramatic tension. Now, I think we did talk a little bit about the necessity of player buy-in, that if you didn't have the player buy-in, you couldn't build the tension.
Yeah, Chad particularly mentioned it. He talked about setting the whole mood, seeing the candles, and people walking in saying that's lame.
But the point here that he starts off with, and he develops this more in a little bit, and I'll get to that here in a second, that I think is worth mentioning here, is the presupposition that you have a GM who is socially or dramatically gifted enough to do that. Let's say you're in a group where you have a GM and the guy maybe can put together a good game, can run it very fairly, can come up with a good story, but isn't the most energetic or descriptive guy when he runs the game. With someone like that, they are in a very different position where maybe there's some skills they need to learn, or maybe there are no skills they need to learn. Maybe they're just wired in a certain way to where they're just not predisposed to being very good at that sort of thing.
There's games and then there's games. Someone who knows the rule system inside and out and can come to the table with a brilliant new tactical map every single week has a skill that I don't have. If he can't set the mood, set a dramatic story going, really run a world that's reactive to the actions of players like I can do, maybe he can run a game that's a lot more fun for the more tactical simulationist type of player. Of course, it would be better if he could run a great story. It would be better if I could run novel and innovative combats every time, but no one person can do everything.
Well, and what we're going to get back to here in a second is he actually gave what I think is a fairly practical bit of advice to people who maybe don't have that predisposition to that skill set, because I think it is a fair point to say that, look, you know, if you don't come to a game with the same exact skills we have, and instead you're gifted in areas that we're not, that some of the advice we give may simply be beyond your reach. And let me stress, I'm not saying that to down anyone, because I'm sure there's things you're better at than we are. It's just maybe this isn't it. But he goes on to say, in my mind, players need two basic things to get that buy-in and set the stage for the tension: control and consequences. Now, consequences we talked about, but here's what he says about control. I've been in railroaded games, and there's no tension in those games. Why? Because there's never a question about what's going to happen next. Even if you don't know what will happen, it doesn't matter what you do, because whatever will end up happening anyhow. And he's damn right. I've been in that game, and this is kind of the flip side of what we're just talking about. I have gamed with some guys who are very good storytellers, were very energetic, very charismatic game masters, but because of the fact they had in mind an outcome, and no matter what you did, you weren't going to offset it, that tension was not there, because exactly as he said, no matter how interesting it got, the ending was predictable.
You know what, though? I think the tension can be there, but it's a different form of tension for me, because I've played in that too. The tension is in the fact that you know that it's going to happen that way and there's not a damn thing you can do about it, but you're beating your head against the wall trying to do it anyway, because I know that's where I've been.
Is that tension or frustration?
Well, frustration. I don't know. I don't know. It makes me tense. It makes the muscles in my neck hurt.
There's
that's
the
like
tension of the last stand and the thrill of fighting the enemy that is seemingly invincible. And even in those situations, even in situations where the plot is completely non-variable, there is the question of, are we going to win this fight or are we going to lose it? Or there should be anyway. Yeah. There are GMs that not only write the whole story, but also prevent you from losing no matter how dumb you are, and they're committing the sin twice. That said, the tension of what if we went left instead of right and something different actually happened needs to be there in a game, and because of that, Hal is correct.
Maybe if they don't have the skill set, this is still a skill that can be learned or at least self-taught. It's a matter of scale. Start small with something that you think that you can do. Try and build up from there. You know, you test it out, see if it works, and then remember what you did, and then adapt it to the next step. You know, you don't have to go full bore like you guys described in 2.11. There are steps that can be taken to get to that point. And if you have sympathetic players who are willing to work with you, that, of course, is going to help the situation.
Do you mean the point of dramatic immersive storytelling where you light the candles, or the point of an open-ended universe, or both?
Well, I would say it's probably, well, I don't want to say one is easier than the other, because again, it does depend on what you have and what you can do, but I think that the open-ended universe and maybe storytelling aspects of the game might be a better place to start.
Yeah, I would agree. It's easier to write a flow chart with different ways you can go than it is to get everyone doing the goblin voice.
I think that a trap that GMs fall into when they get into the style of game that Hal is mentioning is, I think what they do is they try to envision the entirety of the campaign,
the entire dramatic arc,
completely.
Yeah.
I mean, they script it out in their head exactly how they want it to go because it's so damn cool. They have this awesome idea,
and
they're so fixated on that they can't allow themselves to change. What you need to do is you need to have an idea, a basic idea where you want to go, and give some a skeletal outline of points to get there, but those can always change. And you have got to go into each session saying, my players can do something in this session where it will just completely change the ending. And if that happens, it's cool. I will just change the outcome accordingly. That's what you've got to do. If you don't, you're going to get into that railroading of a story. Well, and that's,
I think if you're ever sitting there and you're thinking, I had this really cool thing planned, my players are doing something to keep that from happening, damn my players, they just keep getting in the way, at that point, you've crossed that line.
You've got an attitude problem as a GM. Let me give you an example from movies. Two horror movies, one of which gave me a sense of tension, one of which didn't. The one that did not was Rob Zombie's House of a Thousand Corpses. Being familiar with all the tropes of horror movies, I knew at every given point what was going to happen. You know, there were times that he could overwhelm me with the gore of a scene or some of his really outlandish costumes. And I'll have to give the man credit. He was damn good at doing those things. But at every turn, it's like they're going to attempt this and they're going to fail. They're going to attempt this and they're going to fail. When the girl's creeping down the hallway, she's going to get killed or maimed or tortured or whatever. And as a result, I found myself at points through the movie actually somewhat bored, drumming my fingers. I knew exactly where it was headed. Another movie, which was probably maybe less well put together, but actually created that tension for me, was the recent remake of The Hills Have Eyes. The reason being, because throughout the first half of the movie, you have the very stereotypical, all the tropes horror movie. But about halfway through, this one guy who's this very unlikely fighter, it's just this like hippie guy who finally just has enough, takes an axe and says, I'm going to find the bastards doing this and I'm going to have it out with them. This broke every horror trope. And when he went out to do that, I really did not know if he was going to survive or if he was going to win. And in some of these fights, how he was going to win. And I'm not saying I'm holding this up as Oscar worthy material, but suddenly that tension was back because of the fact that I didn't know how this was going in. This was starting to move away from the tropes.
You know, what that sort of demonstrates to me is sort of, from a GM standpoint, that is your players taking initiative and changing things. I think that's what
but
that
the
is.
GM
because
being
that guy did something, out of the norm. Instead of being reactionary to the things that are killing everybody, he's like, screw this, I'm going after the bastards myself before they kill everybody.
But imagine,
and that
moment,
is something. Yeah,
imagine
you've got to allow that as a GM.
Exactly. If these were role-playing games, and Rob Zombie was running a game, And I said, I'm going to take a 45 with 8 shells, and I've got 6 brain cells to rub together. You're still not going to win. Whereas in this other one, there really was a possibility this guy could do it. Now, let me go on to continue reading what Hal says, because this is where I think he gets into a point that I think is completely valid that we didn't raise. So he continues saying, consequences also have to be there. Can you make a wrong decision? Will you be able to go too far? Will different choices have noticeably different outcomes? Okay, so control and consequence. Here's the point I wanted to get to. I think this is why combat is a major source of tension in many campaigns. No matter how crummy the GM's story, combat is the time when a player gets to have a say in what's happening. No one but you gets to decide what to do on your turn. And combat has at least the illusion of consequences. Flub your roll and you could get killed, or you could end up killing someone you'd only intended to knock out. What if your poor decision gets someone else killed? And I think he raises there a point that we glossed over, because on this show, we have always been on such a crusade to get people to add story to their games that I think he raises wonderfully how combat can accomplish the very kind of story tension we were talking about if used in its proper perspective, because of the fact that he's absolutely right. Combat is the one place in the game where, assuming the GM's not cheating, you have control and consequence.
Big assumption.
Yeah, and it is a big assumption, because I've been in the games where the GM was cheating. But you have control and consequence.
You know, and that's one thing going from GM to GM. Playing with Chad, we always know when we go into a combat that we're going to win this combat. He wants us as the players to win. He's just throwing it out as a bone for us sometimes. And there's none of that tension there that there is in a Skies of Glass combat, for example. When we know you're not trying to kill us when you run the game, there's still that chance that could happen. I mean, it's just different mechanics as well as part of it. That tension just isn't there in a Chad combat that is there for yours.
Well, and I mean, you don't know if you're going to live or die in my combats. I think Dan and Pat can both testify to that.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's because of the fact that, and we talked about this in another episode, one of the things that I do like about the presence of an invasive rule system, a mildly invasive rule system, is the fact that the dice become that random arbiter that no one can argue with, that even the GM, presuming they're playing fair, is bound by.
I roll my dice in front of a screen because I want everyone to know.
Yeah.
The number said yay, and this is now how we all have to react to the story.
We all, including the Game Master, have to react to it.
90% of the reaction is done by the Game Master.
So the one thing I didn't think about when we were talking about tension in the first episode, we discussed talking about the players ahead of time. You know, next game, I want to do something a little differently. I want to try to set up a spooky feel or something. I never even thought about it, but you could actually ask your players, okay, next game, I'm looking for a spooky feel.
Sure you can.
What do you think puts you in that mood? What would be creepy for you?
My loan check.
Yeah, just get the feel from the players the game beforehand, and then you're going in not with a, I'm trying to set the mood for what would make me feel creeped out.
Right.
You kind of have that feel from them going in.
Well, and I think something else that Hal raises in his post is the fact that you have to, as a game master, play to your strengths. If you're not the sort of person who can get that by using music and storytelling, that doesn't mean you're out of options. That some of the options we dismiss simply because we're in this sort of reactionary gaming mode of, you know, combat so overplayed, let's talk story, that, you know what, combat is a possible way of bringing that tension back to the game. Related to tension, the other topic we want to talk about today, and this is one that, Wayne, you raised a while back, and John had some good thoughts on, so I wanted to save this until we get him on the episode, but I have been blueballing this topic for months now, is temptation and moral quandary. Now, let me frame this discussion by first of all saying what this isn't. This is not an alignment system debate.
Damn it.
And now I realize no one up until this point in gaming history has ever really had an alignment debate.
We're just not ready for it.
Yeah.
No, we're not ready for it. We're not mature enough yet. We need another 4 years before we can tackle this topic.
The others don't really exist.
I did argue in second edition that chaotic neutral was objectively the best alignment. But God, let's not go down that path.
So even though that would be taking on completely wild frontier in gaming discussion, I think we're going to go ahead and skip past that. And instead, what we are talking about here more specifically is this question. How do you create meaningful temptation for the characters that will challenge their growth and decisions? For example, doing such and such will bring you to success, but also cause you to violate your precepts in a way that makes you meaningfully struggle.
This is part of the monomyth. The hero always has a quick and easy way to win that's going to screw him over.
It was actually Dresden Files that inspired me to bring up this topic.
Yeah,
it's something that just happens in prose a lot.
Yeah, it's and Jesus in the desert. I mean, it goes back forever.
I wouldn't know how to get that into a game.
So the thing we want to look at here is, just as we talked about back in 2.11, how do you create a sense of tension in your game? We're now looking at how do you create a sense of temptation or a sense of real moral quandary. And I think the first piece of advice I would throw out is the same one I did with tension, which is you have to find some way, or it is best if you can find some way, to bridge the in-character / out-of-character gap, to make the issues that are confronting the character also issues that are difficult for one reason or another to the player. And I think there are several ways you can go about doing this. For example, you could have in-game consequences. We're going to talk about several examples here, one of which is dark side points in the Star Wars D20 system.
Dresden Files, you use dark magic consequences.
The other is you can do it through personal consequences, ones that have more of a moral, emotive feel to them. For example, you have to shoot this one kid to save the world. Something like Damien out of The Omen or whatever. Something where the choice itself is not just difficult for the character, but may in fact also be difficult for the player.
And the players generally will assume there's got to be a way to get around it.
You know, with that specific example, or even some of these other ones, there's got to be more that goes on with it. Because I've been with too many players and too many games where you're presented with that situation where you got to kill this kid, you know, to save the world. Okay. And then, you know, the trigger's pulled and the kid's dead. Because the player doesn't grasp the concept of that this is actually a small child. The buy-in is not there from the player, so you have to create that buy-in.
Well, bingo, and that's what I'm talking about with the whole in-character, out-of-character gap bridging, that I think you have to find out what the player values both in and out of the game, and you have to find some way to make them weigh one value against another. That they desire A and they desire B, and now you create a situation where A and B are mutually exclusive. And you are absolutely right, Chris, that if there is no emotional attachment, if there is no buy-in, if either the player or the character are designed such that they do not care about something, whatever hook, whatever quandary you put in front of them will not matter. If they are so checked out of the game world that the imaginary kid is nothing more than the imaginary kid to them, then, yeah, this becomes a real easy choice, and you can never create any kind of genuine temptation.
And I think part of that, to make the job a little bit easier for the game master, really comes during the character creation process. I mean, if you know as a GM going into this that you're going to want to present your players and characters with, you know, those moral quandaries, you need to come up with a series of questions during character generation, A, that address certain things about the character that may come up later on in the campaign where you're going to spring this on them. But then also, like you said, to help get that buy-in, you got to address questions specifically to the player and find out, what their beliefs are on certain topics and certain situations. So you can essentially marry the two as the campaign goes on and create those situations.
You know, and if you're giving them the tough choice, you need to be ready for them to make either choice. What are you going to do if it came down to this? And they have to cap the kid to save the world, and they refuse to do it. Does the world end right there? Is that the end of the campaign? Or do you keep going and you have to have something else ready to go?
Allies could quickly become enemies if the other 9 people that captured the kid so you could kill him have their guns pointed on you and you won't kill him.
Yeah.
That's always fun.
If the chips really fell that hard like that, I would actually call that successful.
Because, absolutely. No, I because, think that'd be
because
amazing.
Absolutely. Because it's players playing their characters as they should be playing their characters. And so even if it totally destroys the GM's vision of how this may have come out, how his campaign would have ended, you know, his dream date as he set it all up, it's still a better ending because everyone's more true to what they're doing.
Yeah.
Well, so that's assuming it's at the end, too. If it's in the middle and you had a whole nother half of the campaign planned, that could kind of
the end. I mean, the hero who dies rather than commit apparently inevitable evil is another one of the great stories, and there's nothing wrong with being that.
So is the gist of your advice, at least on this point, to make sure that the player has a sufficiently developed character and a sufficiently developed understanding of their character to know what would matter.
I think so, and I think it, and I think it's on both sides of the screen that that is understood, that if the GM is going to ask these questions of the player about their character, then the GM has got to make sure that he holds that player's character's feet to that fire later on in the thing. If you know, if they, if you make an explicit moral statement in your character creation, say, my character would never do this under any circumstances, it's almost your obligation to test that theory and make sure that that is indeed true later on. And A, because it's what they wrote, you want to make sure they're not just doing that to satisfy you as a GM. But then also, too, it's great dramatic tension. Just like we had, like you guys talked about in 2.11, where you there's an opportunity right there to create some dramatic tension by putting that moral quandary in there. And yeah, and creating temptation.
I think part of what you're getting at is that the character has to be bought in. This can't all come from the GM. You can't just say, well, if you shoot the kid, you lose 4 wisdom forever. I mean, the usual carrots and sticks don't apply when you're trying to put between a rock and a hard place, and the player's got to make the tough call.
The players have to feel invested in what they're doing. If they know that letting this prisoner go for some reason, even though he's offering a tremendous amount of wealth or whatever it is, that that NPC may go back and raise the village where he grew up, there needs to be maybe a setup scenario or session or encounter where that character does interact with people from his hometown. And, you know, he knows, you know, Fred down at the, you know, Colored Animal Inn, and he knows this person here who's the village idiot, and all these other people who he knows now are going to die because he just decided to take money over moral standitude.
You know, and I don't know if you have this in your notes, Dan, but the more I hear the conversation, the more I really see two different kinds of temptations here. There is the one big temptation that we've just been discussing a lot of shoot the kid, save the world, that kind of thing.
Right.
But then there's the long temptation. The long building temptation. The character has the ability to access this power, but there's a side effect.
Wayne, I've got 6 examples here that I came up with, each of which I think demonstrate a slightly different angle of the character temptation. And one of them I have on here, you started to bring up, and then I cut you off. So I'm going to let you go ahead and do it. Start with the one you were on earlier.
Lord of the Rings. That's one of the big ones. You know, he's got the ring. That temptation is always there and present. Slide the ring on, you disappear.
That's why Boromir dies.
Yeah.
I mean, Tolkien has created a moral universe. The big question is, do you live in Tolkien's universe or do you live in, you know, George R. R. Martin's A Song of Rape and Nipples?
Yeah, I mean,
if you live in a universe where being good is good and being bad leads you to your doom, you can't be Boromir.
Yeah,
and you're right.
John, I know you're a big fan of the Dresden Files series, yeah, too. It's all about temptation.
Exactly.
A lot of
that universe. Yeah, Harry all can of only these... do things that are good, and he can't do bad things with good goals in mind.
Yeah, and he has all it's of these powers available, but there's always a side effect. Our current game, we have this built-in system. Pat's character had all of these powers and all these abilities he could use based on using a chip. But the temptation never really happened. There were, I think, only once that you actually used a chip in-game because you never felt that need to.
Because you're going to have to pay the piper at some point. And that's what breaks the fourth wall. And in my mind, those are the most powerful scenes within an RPG are those that do break the fourth wall, where the player has to struggle with something personally. And in this game, Pat decides to spend one of his chips. It's going to come back at him. Just like when Frodo decided to put on the ring, yeah, he would disappear. And there were times that he may have had to do that to save his own life. But each time he does that, he gets worse and worse off and less in control and more mentally and physically destroyed. And so there was this ongoing temptation to it where he would gain a real value from using it, but also pay a real price for doing it.
And personally, I think that temptation is harder to do. The one-time big temptation, that can be set up pretty easily. I mean, I don't want to say easy, but I can see more ideas for me at least flow for that. The how do you get your players on the long temptation, that seems more complicated to me.
I think it has to come from the player, and I actually have a gaming story. The character I'm playing right now is a lawful good sorcerer with white dragon bloodline. It's Pathfinder. White dragons are not lawful good. They're chaotic evil. So the thing I'm wrestling with him is, would it be better if he could just get rid of the power entirely? Is retaining that sort of ability along with that drive to commit evil justified, even though you know you risk running out of control with it? So as to your earlier point with Dresden, even if the great power doesn't come with an explicitly huge drawback, is it insidious to have great power at all? That was the point of Tolkien. That's why they kept the ring from Gondor. The good guys could have gone and curb stomp Sauron if Boromir or Faramir had thrown the ring on. But then whoever had the ring would have been just as bad as Sauron. He would have been the new Dark Lord. So if you want to incorporate a dimension of power corrupts absolute, power corrupts absolutely, you can leave that sort of trinket in their hand and say, sure, yeah, go ahead, fire up the Hand of Vecna and then see what happens.
I mean, at that point, do you have to throw in more challenges? Do you have to throw in more combat to make it more and more difficult? Because if that threat's never there, they never have a reason to use it.
That's a good thing. Do you use it as an ejection seat? Do you throw this adversity to them and say, well, the blood sword of death is hanging at your hilt. If you took it out, you could kill them all. Huh? That'd be a good move.
I think if you escalate the power level of the enemies, I think you've kind of missed the opportunity. The point is, if you take out the blood sword of death or whatever.
Yeah, you should win if you do that.
You win.
But at horrible, horrible cost.
But guess what?
You're now worse than the orcs.
Yeah. And
guess what? Your mom dies.
Yeah.
And it now becomes a character thing of, you know, maybe at some point you pass him a note card and say, yeah, your wife you were just talking to, she said something you didn't like, you just killed her. And you don't even know why you did it. Because guess what? This thing is taking you over. This thing is wrecking you. And so, yeah, you are really powerful, but you are doing things you don't want to do as a result. And so now you have to make this really tough call each time you do it.
Yeah, magic can make the temptation of power much easier because we can create intelligent weapons and armor and rings that override your own will in what is an obvious metaphor for what power does to the human psyche.
Yeah, and I don't think I would have done like what you just suggested. I don't think I'd slide someone a note saying, you just killed this character because you're losing control. What I would probably do is actually start having them make will checks. As situations happen.
It's just, exactly. Yeah. There are many ways you could approach it.
I would say will checks at least. I would hope
that adds intention to the game. Because now there's this whole aspect of, you know, this is going on. You're rolling a dice to get tension. I have no problem with that.
Right.
You're rolling a dice outside of combat because, you know, you've done something now and this is your consequence.
Yeah. In fact, that's actually something I have going on in my Friday gaming group. There's a guy who's got in his hands right now two cursed magical swords. It's actually their sickles, but the point is that they are slowly corrupting his mind, and every so often I have him roll will check, and if he does well, he basically maintains control. As it slips, he's actually falling farther and farther under the control of some evil forces. In his case, he doesn't per se have a choice because he can't get rid of them. They're stuck to him, but nonetheless, rolling that die does give him that sense of struggle, and I think in a situation where he did have choice, that same struggle would occur.
And at that case, if you want to increase the temptation, you can use this item, but next time you're getting a -1 on your will roll.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the old rules, I don't know how the rules are for intelligent weapons now, but back in like 2E, if you had an evil sword and you kept using it, you kept getting minus more and more and more, and that thing was going to win. It was just a matter of time.
I found that World of Darkness, at least the old World of Darkness, did a lot of really good mechanics for kind of representing temptation and the potential to have this great power, but there were bad things that came with it.
The Beast Within, was that one of them?
That was one. I think that was Werewolf that called it that.
I thought it was a vampire.
No, the vampires had a beast.
Yeah, the vampires had a beast within.
Did too, and they had a humanity score
right
that represented their control, and the more you made use of the power of being a vampire, the more your humanity dwindled. Mage had a similar thing with Paradox. You had this huge amount of power at your disposal, but doing so damaged reality around you, and there were consequences that came with it.
In Dresden Files, they have free will, and you actually can go so far down the path. This is the role-playing game, Dresden Files. You actually can go so far down the path, if you cross a certain line and your free will drops below a certain point, your refresh rate does, your character just became an NPC. You're creating a new character. Yours lost control.
I think what you guys are talking about, I think that your approach from the game master side of things, I think really a lot depends on your player. I have absolutely no problem with applying mechanics to enforce the negative side effects of choosing a negative temptation. But if Johnny G was at my table, honestly, I don't think I would ever use a mechanic to do that because though I've never actually gamed with John, I know enough of his style that I would actually trust him by passing notes in giving him indicators saying, you don't necessarily feel this way about these people that you're encountering, despite what all your party members are saying. Or you now feel an incredible sense of anger towards this person, even though what they said to you might be determined as just a minor slight. And I would expect him to roleplay that appropriately. And if he didn't, obviously, then I could certainly resort to mechanics to enforce what is going on with his character that he may or may not know about. But it almost would seem more enjoyable to me to see that player buy into the fact that they are going down that wrong path because of the temptation they took and act in a way that enhances the game. And in a certain sense, then I would even reward that if it was appropriate through mechanics.
Exactly the same way. And that's actually how Chad did handle me. I once played a character who was a gambling addict, and I would give him a little cut here and a little cut there, and actually would do some seriously underhanded crap to get a little more money to play a little more cards. But eventually, Chad brought it to a head and literally had the devil come out and try to buy my soul at a game of dice. And I was like, no, my character is tempted by this. This is his weak point, but he's not going to sell out himself and all his friends. He finds that moment of resolve and continues.
Some and players, I think that's the only way to do that with, too. I can't imagine trying to get that feeling mechanically with Chad. I don't think it would work.
You guys are absolutely right in that you have to tailor this based on the game you're in and the players and what works for the players, how much you can trust them to do this, how deep their characters are to begin with. But one thing that I would like to point out that comes out in some of the other examples I have here is there are some places where I think the rule system of the game helps to create that. Let me start with an example from our homebrew, Skies of Glass. In that game, there's no hit points. There's no cure light wounds. You instead have injuries. You may see a situation where you've got a gun. If you draw it out and you pull the trigger and you get somebody in the torso or the head, you're going to mess them up bad. You're probably going to take them down. It's an easy way to resolve a situation. But just like in real life, you also run the risk of you may be the one to get shot. And suddenly having hemorrhaging artery is a very different sort of thing than losing a few hit points. And so players really think twice about resorting to violence, about looking at the situation. And it creates this exact sort of temptation. If you take it to a certain level, it may be an easy way to get out of what would otherwise be a difficult role-played negotiation. But if you choose just to shoot the shopkeeper that won't give you the discount you want, you could also find yourself walking out of the place missing a hand. And this makes people think. Now let me give you one that's a little bit less gruesome. In the D20 and D20 revised Star Wars rules, I've played Saga, but I don't remember specifically how this is handled in there. One of the things they draw out in those rules is that the Jedi are not per se good guys in the sense that we would think of within a Judeo-Christian Western morality. They're instead, I suppose, more Buddhist, I guess I'll say. To them, desire itself is a form of corruption because it's a foothold for the dark side. And so let's say you have someone you love and you want to protect, giving into that, something that we would call good, in fact, can start racking up dark side points. And the one time that I tried playing a Jedi in Star Wars, there were many times where my personal morality, my sense of right and wrong, the things that I wanted to do, I knew, number one, would violate the heart of how that character was supposed to behave, and number two, would give me a mechanical disadvantage even if I didn't care about point A. I didn't care about playing him consistently. Point B was I was still going to have the mechanical disadvantage of I'm going to start racking up dark side points. And these dark side points are going to start affecting me in a very negative way, both in terms of the way people react to me and the way my character develops. And so I had to start making hard choices. You know, something happened to my buddy and I want to go get justice for it. And the courts let the guy off. But if I go fix the problem, and maybe I even know this guy's going to murder again, but if I go kill him before he murders again, I'm going to the dark side. And so now it's like, well, what do I want to do? And my personal morality was clashing with that of the characters. And it did create some real thoughtful moments, some very memorable gaming moments, as I had to wrestle with that and make those calls.
So the question is what to do when your personal morality clashes with your character's morality, or was that just sort of a self-contained observation?
I think that's a point.
Okay.
I think that's just more of an example of how I can recall this kind of temptation cropping up within games. I don't think that is the punchline of the topic,
yeah.
More as it is an incarnation of this topic.
Yeah, no, it's certainly difficult if you play a loyalist or a rebel for that matter, and you have this code that allows you to kill, maim, beg, borrow, and steal in service of whatever end, and you're someone who really doesn't believe that the ends justify the means, but you have to play your character. And so if you're playing a game that explores moral ambiguity, it's a good opportunity.
Dan, most of the temptations we've talked about have been, you know, on a larger scale with just a little bit of the smaller scale. But let's talk a little bit about just small scale temptations where it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, a complete disruption of the campaign. I mean, simple things I'm talking about, like either bribes or temptations of a more romantic nature, that kind of thing. Do you have any examples on your list of that?
The only one I have like that in here is this one came from if you were playing some kind of a noir game, or if you were playing Shadowrun, but were playing someone who's of a more decent nature. You're not just total street scum. Let's say that you have to call on a crime boss, that something went down, you're trying to figure out, and you know if you called this crime boss, he might be able to give you some kind of insight that would help you resolve the situation. And you're not even going to have him go out and do a hit on a preschool. I mean, it's not something like that. It's just he might just give you a little piece of information. But if you do it, first off, you may owe him a favor now.
Trouble with the supplier? Go to Pauly. Trouble with the management? Go to Pauly. But the other side of the coin is, on the first of the month, you pay me. Restaurant burns down, you pay me. You guys have all seen Goodfellas.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the second thing is, from an outsider's perspective, once again, especially if you're trying to be the good guy, they're going to start questioning who it is you're associating with. It may even come down to you yourself just don't want to stoop to having to admit. Let's say you're playing a cop. As a cop, you know, if you've got a character who's got an ego about it, you want to do what's right the right way. Do you really want to have to admit that you just made a deal with the local mafia boss or some street corner gangbanger to solve a crime? Knowing you had to give something to their world, even if it was just a nod of respect to get what you wanted. So, yeah, I think there are smaller examples. Now, what I would say is with these smaller examples, it definitely requires a different caliber of character and player, because the small things aren't going to matter to someone who's real just beer and pretzels hack and slash. They might get the big things, but the fact that they've got to knock over an apple cart to get an apple for someone down the street, I mean, that's not going to really bug them. It's like, who cares? I just tipped it over. I can pick it back up, you know? So I think you've got to look at the caliber of what's going on in the game. And that may make the little choices less useful sometimes, but
I think the little choices are useful as opportunities to fail, because they allow you to illustrate that this isn't really window dressing on the character sheet that I just happen to overcome every single time. I really am grappling with this. And it really will mean something when, in the defining moment, I say, no, my loyalty to my principals or my friends will overcome my desire to indulge in this power grabbing or this addiction or whatever it is that I'm tempted by.
As a player who's actually added things like that into his character, it really does frustrate you, too. If you have something about your character, he has a weakness to this. He is a overwhelming good guy that always will step up for the little guy. And that situation never comes up in game.
Yeah, that's annoying.
Well, let me give you guys an example. Going back to a campaign we played a while back, there was a guy who was running around with a group of bandits who was schizophrenic. The guy was mentally ill. He genuinely really did not understand what he was doing. And at one point, Chad put a crossbow bolt into him. And he started screaming in pain, but his buddies were nearby. Now, this was a guy who, I suppose, while he had done bad things, given his mental state, I guess we'll call him innocent of his acts. He didn't totally perceive what was going on. And you guys had to deal with the issue of, look, do you try and help this guy? Do you try and let him live out of mercy because of the fact that he doesn't understand what he's doing? Or on the flip side, do you get rid of him because his constant yelling is going to bring his friends? And in that moment, I believe, if memory serves, the choice was made without really any discussion.
Actually, we had two people make different choices.
Uh-huh.
I really tried to save the character.
Yeah.
And I was playing a veterinarian, which was the closest we had to a doctor, because to be honest, it amused me, the idea of being a veterinarian working on everyone else in the group.
And Chad slit his throat.
Chad actually,
no.
He took that bolt that was hanging in there, because I did all my around. Medical roles. It was the first time I used that. I really pushed towards it, because in my mind, that's what this character was all about. He was a veterinarian, yes, but he was a doctor. He wasn't going to let this guy that wasn't harmful anymore die. And then afterwards, Chad's character comes over, grabs that bolt, and twists it all around until the guy bleeds to death, basically. Mm-hmm. both characters were completely and totally in character. Both characters had that temptation. My character was a coward. He didn't want to let the guys on the ridge go running away. But what was important to him was more healing this.
I think that right there is what you have to figure out as a game master, is what is a situation you can put your players in where they both want and don't want the exact same thing.
And I think it's a great thing if multiple people in the group have to struggle with that decision and they don't make the same ones.
It's a new layer of temptation. Do you want to upset the party? Look, think about it in your daily life. How many things do you do at work, at home, with your circle of friends that may not really be your true opinion, but you do it simply to keep the peace? And some part of you wants to bust out and say all these things, but some part of you is like, no, it's not worth the consequences. And so once again, you have this thing at work in you where you want something and don't want it at the exact same time.
And how much more careful would we be if we were all armed to the teeth and completely undisciplined?
An armed society is a polite society.
Yeah, and there was no police. Like, we'd be really careful if we were an adventuring party.
Well, I think organizations are probably one way to bring up those situations from time to time. If the players or characters are members of an organization, then they're going to feel a tie to it, and they're not going to want to do something that might jeopardize their status. So when the knighthood that you're a part of tells you to do something that may not be a moral thing to do, do you go ahead and you do it anyway to stay with the group, or do you break your ties?
You can unfortunately go too far down that path, though. In the same Skies of Glass game, we were mercenaries, but we cared so much about our town that we weren't going out and leaving the town or doing things because we were afraid of the consequences. We go rile up this group of ists, they're going to come into town and start killing people.
Even though there may have been a big paycheck involved.
Yeah.
Now, I do also want to say that just as we talked about with so many topics lately, this is something that has to be kept in its proper perspective. There is a point of gratuity. There is a point where you can create so many situations so artificially that it just becomes a tired theme or an annoyance to the game. Like so many other things, this ought to be a seasoning to your game, not a constantly beaten drum.
Temptation is not tempting if you see it every day.
And on top of that, also the more shocking the temptation. Look, not every choice has to be, this little three-year-old is patient zero. Do you off him or ends to save the world, or do you let the world die from the disease he carries? Look, not every choice needs to be that deranged. Do certainly keep this in check with your group's general tastes and the history of your game.
And sometimes you don't even have to drop him in artificially. I mean, how many times have we played a game where you fought the bad guy was shooting to kill 5 minutes ago, but now he's disarmed. So it's kind of a dick move to kill him, but if you let him go, he's probably going to get back in the fight against you at some point. It would be easy if you had a prison right there, but you're four people in the middle of the desert, so really the only choices are to strip him down to the point where he can't survive anymore and kill him slowly, or kill him right here, or let him go with all his stuff, but then he's going to get his friends.
Or tie him up and drag him with you and try and convert him, try and talk him out of what he's doing. And it's even better when everyone in the party wants a different option.
Exactly. This happened to me in my game 2 weeks ago. I was the aforementioned lawful good loyalist who had disarmed the traitor, but said, hey, the penalty for treason is death. You want to look in the medieval code of laws. There's about a million of them against even thinking about the king dying. I just put him down right there, and my character didn't think twice about it. Never mind that he was disarmed, blinded magically by me, and all his friends were dead.
We ran into that exact concept as well in that last Epoch of Rysos game. You know, Dan, you set up this situation where there were some guys that did something what we all thought is very evil, but because it was outside of Republic space, it was legal. And we all had to come to the conclusion of, are we going to tell everyone else about this? Are we going to try to turn these guys over that are actually didn't do anything illegal? Do we execute them ourselves? And we all had different answers about what we wanted to do with these guys. And we just basically struggled with that concept of there's no good answer. Everything we want to do here is a moral choice that we don't want to make.
Vigilante justice is a very common one to throw in there. Is it right to take the law into your own hands? This person didn't technically break any laws. I can't turn him over to the authorities. Is it right for me to do something about it myself?
Or even worse, I saw him do it, but I have no way to prove it. So I know if we brought charges, he'd get off. Right. Do I just put a bullet in his head right now?
Is Batman really moral?
Yeah, exactly. Are you the Batman or are you the Punisher? Which one is right? Are either of them
and
right?
It's not so much which one is right. It's what your what do you feel? How does your character respond to that temptation to do either or? I mean, and that's really what we're talking about here. Is that here is your situation, and the rightness or wrongness of it doesn't necessarily matter per se. It matters how your character or how you as a player interprets your character's motivation.
Yeah, based you can impute all of these dilemmas upon the character as well as you can the player. You're right. In the context of role-playing, it's what the character thinks that counts.
So, yeah, I think the punchline, once again, is just to know your characters, know your players, to know that they've got them sufficiently developed, and to figure out places where you can get them to really struggle between the two options that are present. So I think that's where we're going to go ahead and wrap this one up.
Just in case the Batman's listening, I didn't mean anything bad. Don't come kill me.
Batman wouldn't
worry about kill. Batman doesn't kill
you. Batman doesn't kill you. He might break your legs
or something.
The Punisher
is listening, on the other hand.
Yeah. As for the rest of you guys, thank you for tuning in. We look forward to seeing all of you, each and every one of you, at FearTheCon 4. And
we are tempting you to come.
Yeah, a roll will save against FearTheCon 4.
Pat may drop DC 80. If you come to FearTheCon.
Make that DC 5.
That's true. And we will catch you next time.
See you.
Later. Ciao. Guys.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2010. Listeners are free to use the show in a non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.